Surely he did not mean to compel her to search the house room by room. She sat down on the edge of the bed and rubbed the back of her neck. This couldn't possibly still be a game, unless the point was to give offence and cause frustration. But if it wasn't a game... If it wasn't a game, it would mean he'd had enough of her for the time being. Impossible. The night before he had been so aroused, he had not even taken the time to disrobe. He must want her still. And intensely, too. Yet after an entire day away, instead of seeking her company, he had chosen his own. She lay down on her bed, her mood glum. She wished she knew where he was. She wished she understood what drove his strange decisions. She wished she'd remembered never to lower her guard where he was concerned. She was to trust him only in bed and nowhere else, no matter how adorably he styled the dress dummies. She fell asleep dreaming that he came through the connecting door, full of smiles and apologies. Chapter 11. Louisa would have preferred to hunt him down the next morning and demand an answer, but she woke up to a house preparing itself for battle. The first batch of guests for the house party was expected in the afternoon, and had she somehow come to the belief that she needed only to stand back and let the great machinery below stairs rumble on by itself? How wrong she had been! This was an army, and she its general. It didn't matter that she'd never been anywhere near a proper campaign. Dozens and dozens of decisions now fell to her. Some obviously mattered. Funds needed to be approved so that the extra help hired specifically for the occasion would have their coin at the end of each day. Some were of passionate importance to those directly involved. Mr. Sturgis could not stop agonizing about the combination of linen and fresh flowers at the table. Should it be a white tablecloth to show off the vibrancy of the ranunculus, or should it be a dark tablecloth so that the late Marchioness's blush roses could be displayed to their best advantage? And some made her feel like both a complete bumpkin and a wonderful sage for not caring one way or the other. Should the east lawn be trimmed to the correct height for croquet and the west lawn for tennis, or vice versa? She pretended to reflect on the difference, and then instructed the groundskeeper to seek the master of Huntington. "Did Mr. Connolly find you?" she asked the master of Huntington when she finally saw him, an hour past luncheon, coming down the grand staircase in a light tweed suit. The ideal country gentleman.
"Yes, he did."
He addressed her with an affable familiarity, as if they'd been married years, and a night missing from her bedchamber were nothing for anyone to be concerned about. "And how did you answer him?"
"The west lawn for tennis and the east lawn for croquet. That way there will always be shade, as on hotter days tennis is usually played in the morning and croquet in the afternoon."
"A rich man's concern," she scoffed.
"A rich woman's, too," he answered with a smile at her. "Don't forget what you have become, Lady Renworth."
It was only a half smile, or perhaps less, perhaps only a quarter. But all the same, it was as dazzling.
"If you will excuse me, I must go out and inspect the grouse we will soon be shooting," he said,
leaning in so that his lips brushed her cheek. She laid a hand against his heart, the tweed warm beneath her hand. "I missed you last night. Maybe marriage was not a hotbed of transparency and honesty, but she had never lied when it came to her physical desire for him. Now he no longer smiled. Now he looked at her as he had in their bridal bower, with a ferocity that bordered on vehemence. Only for a second. Then he took her hand in his, kissed her across the knuckles, and departed the front door without a backward glance, leaving her unsure whether she felt better or even worse.
Louisa's husband stepped into her room just as Betsy pronounced her toilette finished. He dismissed Betsy and came to stand behind Louisa, inspecting her in the mirror, his hands behind his back. She had chosen an ornately embroidered dinner gown in a pale lilac brocade, a double strand of pearls, a wedding present from Lady Balfour, about her throat.
"Very nice," he said, "but not quite right yet."
"I would look better if I were more satisfied in bed," she retorted.
"Really?"
He brushed one hand against her pearl necklace.
"I would have said you looked quite ravishing when you'd gone 24 years without."
No doubt she would have come up with a witty and biting repartee, but he did something with her necklace, his warm touches upon her nape causing a cascade of sensations inside her. And now he removed the necklace altogether, placing it on the vanity with a soft click. She wanted him to keep touching her. When he did, she felt less adrift, less cast aside. He pulled a handful of something from his pocket, which, as he placed it around her throat, resolved itself to be a sensational diamond necklace, the gems brilliant with an icy flame.
"From my mother's jewelry collection. All the pieces are yours to keep."
She could not care less about the necklace or the other pieces. Her attention was solely focused on his fingers. Did they linger as he worked the clasp? Did he display the slightest interest in her skin? No, he was completely impersonal, needing no more than 3 seconds to fasten the necklace.
"Now you look perfect," he said, his words just as impersonal. "Shall we go?"
It took Louisa the entire pre-dinner chit-chat and the first course after sitting down before she was able to shove herself back into the role that she'd played so often and so well during the season. There were adjustments to be made, of course. Now it was the ladies she must cultivate. For while her husband's wealth and stature gave her a certain cachet, that was not, by itself, quite enough to elevate her standing to the kind of stratospheric height he enjoyed. And for £5,000 a year, she owed him a wife as popular and well thought of as he. To that end, she made sure she appeared amiable, but also sure of herself, her public persona reflecting, at least in some measure, his cool sophistication. After dinner, the gentlemen rejoined the ladies in the drawing-room. From that moment until the ladies retired, he spoke to her only once, to ask what time she had arranged for coffee and biscuits to be brought in, an inattentiveness that was exactly as it ought to be, as the duty of the host and the hostess was to see to the guests rather than to each other. Yet she felt herself constantly under observation, a sensation not unlike what she'd experienced the night of their first meeting. He would be speaking to each of their 16 guests in turn, or participating in a game of cards, or taking part in a duet, his singing voice remarkably pure and warm, and she would feel the tangible weight of his scrutiny. No solid evidence of this observation, only her intuition. But even her intuition could not quite decipher the nature of his inspection. Did it mean anything at all? Or was he merely making sure that her performance as his wife was satisfactory? At 10 o'clock, coffee and biscuits were served. The ladies, herself included, retired shortly thereafter. She had told her maid not to wait up for her. That freedom of movement now allowed her to conceal herself in the darkness of the solarium across from the billiard room. A quarter of an hour later, the gentlemen arrived in a herd.
"A game, Wren?" asked someone. "I'll put down 20 quid.
"Tomorrow, maybe," answered Louisa's husband. "I will not be staying long enough tonight for an entire game. I am a married man now, with a married man's duties."
His friends chuckled. Some of them teased him good-naturedly. Louisa rubbed her finger on the heavy toile that covered the wall behind her. Did he mean it, or was he only acting the part? Good for his word, he left the billiard room after only a few minutes. She slipped out of the solarium and followed him. At the stair landing he stopped
and turned around, his person only a silhouette. She caught up to him, and together they ascended the steps. "I am not following you around the house," she said, a little defensively, once they were out of earshot of those still in the billiard room. "I only wish for a minute of your time."
"And you are, of course, entitled to that," he said politely. "Shall we go to my sitting room?"
He was making her nervous, and not in a pleasurable way. Instead, she felt like the insolvent young woman she had been until very recently, attempting to persuade a shopkeeper to extend her more credit. She preceded him into his apartment. A moment later, a light came on, then another. She blinked, looking about, not sure what she was seeing. The decor was not English, nor exactly what she thought of as the French style. His apartment was an ecstasy of pastels, white, gold, and sky blue. She almost could not imagine how exuberant it would appear during the day, with sunlight streaming in through the windows. The plaster medallions on the wall, the fresco paintings of pastoral idylls, a ceiling that was the brightest, cleanest sky, with birds in flight, and even a hot air balloon. What the inside of a fairy tale castle looked like, more or less.
"It's beautiful, it's..."
"Rococo is the word you are looking for, I believe."
"Yes, I suppose."
She had no idea what the word meant, except to know that it was the last thing she'd have extrapolated from his otherwise clean, spare style. She liked this rococo interior. It was luminous and joyful. But instead of uplifting her mood, it only made her feel more apprehensive.
What else didn't she know about him? "I would ring for some tea, but the staff has already retired for the night," he said, quite formally.
"Thank you, but I don't need any tea."
"In that case, what can I do for you?"
She bit the inside of her lower lip.
"Perhaps you can explain why you are no longer my lover."
"Am I not?"
"You haven't touched me in 2 days."
"And 48 hours is enough to disqualify me?"
"We are on our honeymoon, and you have given me every expectation that I may expect an attentive and frequent lover."
"You might be recalling things I'd said when I had you in mind as a mistress, whom I might see as little as 20 days out of the year. Marriage is something else altogether."
"Yet I am confident you said to me on our wedding night that you would, that you wanted to fuck me every hour of every day."
The inside of her mouth felt as if it were on fire. The word was incredibly vulgar, yet strangely potent and muscular.
His eyes narrowed, as if he couldn't quite believe what he was hearing. Then he leaned forward a little, his manner almost conspiratorial. "Let me tell you something, my dear. You should never believe what a man says when he is fucking you."
Now it was the inside of her chest that burned.
"If I cannot trust you even in bed, then where can I trust you?"
"I am disappointed. I thought you prudent enough to never trust me anywhere, at any time."
She was just as disappointed in herself. But there was a small part of her that still couldn't quite believe that all her worst suspicions were coming true. That the marriage she'd thought might prove to be ultimately heartbreaking was breaking her heart this moment.
"I should have had it written into the marriage settlement, how often I must be made love to," she said, trying to sound flippant.
He said nothing. She had the sense that he was already waiting for her to leave. Her heart clenched. Was this it? Was her loss to be so abrupt and unceremonious? And would she accept this banishment so meekly, with barely a murmur of protest? She took a step toward him. He regarded her with an impatient condescension. The grand aristocrat who found the country bumpkin a terrible bore. but she couldn't quite comprehend this new reality yet. When she looked at him, she still saw the man who had gone to great lengths with the dress dummies to make her laugh. And only that man. So she took another step forward, and then another, and placed her hand over his heart, his fast-beating heart. She gazed into his eyes. For some reason she could see no contempt in them, only a barely leashed desire. Her hand moved to his jaw, followed by her lips. A chaste kiss, then a touch by the tip of her tongue. He jerked away, but she only moved closer. This time she put her lips to the side of his neck, just above his starched collar. The rain-fresh scent of him made her light-headed with yearning. She grazed him with the moist inside of her lower lip and found herself picked up and pushed against a wall. They stared at each other. Her beautiful lover kept a tight grip on her shoulder, merciless enough to hurt, except she could feel only a desperate thrill. "I seem to have married the horniest girl in all of England," he said softly, but with a sharp edge to his words. "You knew it long before you married me." His eyes were now on her lips. "Yes, I did, didn't I?" he murmured. "Kiss me," she heard herself say. "Kiss me as you did the other night." "But how will a kiss satisfy you? It is satisfaction you want, isn't it? Say yes, and I will give it to you." She could almost not believe what she was hearing. "Yes," she said. "Yes. And yes again." His hand moved lightly down her arm. For a brief moment he encircled her wrist with his thumb and middle finger. But the next second he was dragging her skirts up, his motion swift and efficient. His hand parted her legs, seeking her through the slit of her combination. She was caught off guard. She wanted him to touch her everywhere, of course, but the way he went about it seemed so focused, as if there were no other pleasure to be had except through that one place. But she could not quite deny that it was a quick and instant source of pleasure. She was glad now of his hand that still pinned her to the wall at her shoulder. Without it, her knees just might not support her weight. His fingers! God, those clever fingers! Gentle and forceful by turn, knowing just what to do. Her eyes fluttered closed. The sound of herself panting filled the room. Then she was crying out, her pleasure peaking and cresting. His lips were close to her ear. His breaths, too, were shallow and irregular. She opened her eyes and turned toward him, his forehead against the wall, his eyes tightly shut. She put a hand on his arm, but before she could say a word, he pulled back. Just like that, dropping her skirts and walking away. Halfway across the room, he took out a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his hand, as if he'd touched something dirty. And then he tossed the handkerchief into a wastebasket. She was suddenly shaking.
"I believe my work here is done," he said coolly.
She was too stunned to move or to cry. She'd never once in her life considered herself unfortunate. She had a healthy, loving family. Their roof might leak, but it was still a good enough roof, and they'd always had money to buy food and enough left over to look respectable. But not until this moment did she realize just how fortunate she had always been. She had never before been dealt such deliberate cruelty. He had meant to humiliate her. He had meant to mock her desire for him, and he had meant to show once and for all how little he cared for her. She pushed away from the wall and walked out without another word or another look at him. Felix stood in place for what seemed half the night. He'd always known that he was every inch his mother's son, but still he was stunned by his own viciousness. Being the ideal gentleman meant that his cruelty was treated like a piece of ancient weaponry at a private museum, an objet kept inside a glass cabinet, sometimes studied in the abstract, but rarely handled and never actually wielded. But he had such paltry defence against her. Keeping himself away and otherwise occupied had made him think about her more, not less. The entire time in the drawing-room, as he saw to his guests, he was acutely aware of where she was and what she was doing. Each time she laughed, it was as if she touched him. And when she actually put her hand on him, he could almost not remember why he must keep away. All he wanted was to spend the foreseeable future in her arms, make love, make her laugh, then make love again. Already he thought of how best to make amends. He could write her family for a list of her favourite things. He could show her all the features of her new telescope. He could teach her the mathematics she needed to calculate the orbits of comets and the gravitational pull of planets. He grimaced. This was why he must never allow himself to love. He was all too capable of it, all too willing to give, and all too accustomed to keep giving, even when his gifts were rejected left and right. When he finally took himself to his observatory, clouds had already rolled in. But there he remained until dawn, under a sky he could no longer see. Chapter 12. At the end of the first week of the house party, the guest head count at Huntington had climbed to 40. The house existed in a state of permanent bustle, its occupants consuming caviar by the stone and guzzling 50-year-old claret as if it were so much lemonade. Bread was brought in by the cartload from the village. Crates of crabs, sturgeon, and whitebait arrived packed in straw and ice. Hens, ducklings, and guinea fowls came in latticed cages, emerging from the kitchen only after having been roasted, stuffed, and stewed. Temporary cookmaids and scullery maids chopped and washed alongside frantic sous chefs. Footmen were permanently out of breath. The laundry department operated 6 days a week, bravely attacking mountains of napkins and undershirts. During the day, Louisa rarely had a moment to herself, and she was glad for it. Every servant who approached her with a question or a problem was a welcome distraction, each guest who wanted her attention likewise. At night, well, it actually wasn't too difficult to fall asleep, given that she now woke up at 4 o'clock each morning to spend time with her telescope, which she'd had moved to the balcony outside the sitting room of her apartment. She started with the much-bombarded face of the moon, dear old friend to those lovers of astronomy who could observe only with the naked eye, or a pair of binoculars at best. Then she moved on to the planets. She still remembered her star map, memorized during long-ago childhood summers, so she needed only look for heavenly bodies that were out of place. Mars's moons, Jupiter's spot, Saturn's rings, celestial entities she'd never before seen with her own eyes, bowed before the powerful magnification of her telescope. Only once did she turn the telescope toward the hillock on which the Roman Folly sat. The sun had just risen. The Belvedere was bathed in a lovely champagne-coloured light, and the dress dummies were nowhere in sight. Vanished, like her husband's interest in her. She joined other early risers on daily hikes across the breadth of the estate. Her husband never did, though he was always there to lead interested parties on grouse-terminating expeditions. His friends were people of boundless energy. Groups of cycle enthusiasts regularly charged down country lanes to the bemusement of nearby cattle. The gentlemen played cricket and association football. Ladies thwacked away on the tennis court set up on the west lawn, and almost every afternoon rowing parties and impromptu races took place on the lake. And since one could not come by the appellation of the ideal gentleman without also being a superlative sportsman, Lord Renworth rarely idled, taking part in everything, as graceful and sure-footed running across a grassy field as he was turning about a ballroom. He was the best tennis player among the gentlemen, it was commonly acknowledged, and also the best shot. As for who was the fastest swimmer, that particular question was settled with a contest. Louisa was on a different side of the house, ensconced among the half-dozen or so guests who preferred painting, reading, and gossiping to the more vigorous pastimes. But at the news that at least a dozen gentlemen had waded out into the lake, these supposedly sedentary guests leaped up into a sprint, leaving Louisa no choice but to follow in their wake. A crowd had already gathered at the edge of the water. She would have been glad to remain at the back of the spectators, but once her guests realized that she had come, they stepped aside and waved her through to the front. A dense pack of men were in the waters off the far shore. She couldn't see their faces, but from the rapidly forming wagers, it became apparent that her husband was among the contestants. Near the middle of the lake, the three or four strongest swimmers separated themselves from the pack.
"Mr. Dunlop is in the lead, Mr. Weston behind him, and Lord Renworth in third," a sharp-eyed matron beside Louisa reported.
A man snorted behind her.
"Dunlop'll fade soon enough. Fellow doesn't know how to pace himself. But that should be an interesting contest between Weston and Renworth. Weston's a bit heavy, but he swims like a fish."
As he predicted, Dunlop soon dropped out of the lead, and it came down to a spirited sprint between the two others. Louisa held her breath, not so much invested in the result of the race. What did it matter who came in first? As unhappily gnawing over the prospect of being seen as riveted by his doings, when he couldn't bother to reciprocate that interest. Lord Renworth won by a full body length. He and Mr. Weston came ashore laughing, shaking hands, and congratulating each other in easy camaraderie. They were both minimally clad. Her husband had stripped down to his shirt sleeves, and what garments still remained on him were plastered to his person, limning the strong, lithe form his more formal attires only hinted at. He rolled up his sleeves as he emerged from the lake, exposing long, sinewy arms to the afternoon sun and much avid feminine scrutiny.
"Oh, my," murmured a lady to the right of Louisa. "What a sight!"
"I had better send someone to collect all the clothes left on the other bank," Louisa said, very sensibly.
"Leave them," said another lady, entirely insensibly. "We have no need of them."
It would have seemed odd if she didn't join the ensuing tittering, brought on in large part by the collective admiration for her husband's fine physique. So she did, though all she wanted was to leave, to hide places where she could not possibly be exposed to his beauty and fitness. That was when he saw her, her hand over her mouth, in a fit of silly giggling. She kept on giggling. She was sure. The sound echoed in her head. But a scalding mortification filled her, as if he had just wiped the hand that had touched her on a handkerchief and discarded the latter as not worthy of ever being inside his pocket again. He came to her and kissed her on her forehead.
"Aren't you proud of me?" he murmured, just loud enough for those nearest to overhear.
He touched her like this from time to time, decorously, always before an audience, and always with just a hint of loverly familiarity, a hand on the small of her back, a nudge with his shoulder, and once a playful tug on her hat ribbon as he passed her. She knew why he made such gestures. Without ever consulting each other, they played a pair of secretly devoted lovers, as if they'd been colleagues in the same theatrical production for years upon years. She peered at him from underneath her eyelashes, the pad of her index finger alighting upon a still wet button on his shirt.
"Maybe."
Their gazes held for a moment. Twin arrows of lust and pain pierced her person. It would be so much easier if he weren't such a good actor. If in one brief look he didn't make her feel as if he would give up his entire fortune for one night with her.
"My, my, Felix, what delicious déshabille!"
Startled, Louisa looked toward the speaker, a striking raven-haired woman in a gown of burgundy and gold stripes. Lady Tremaine, back from her man-sampling up north. She approached Lord Renworth, her gloved hands outstretched.
"What is this, Felix? I go off for a few weeks and come back to find you married."
Felix. Appalling intimacy, when everyone else, even his oldest friends, thought it quite adequate to adhere to his title or some variant thereof. He did not seem to mind at all.
"My dear," he said to Louisa, "allow me to present the Marchioness of Tremaine. Lady Tremaine, Lady Renworth."
The two women shook hands.
"We are so glad you could come, Lady Tremaine," said Louisa. "And did you find the charms of Scandinavia as delightful as you had hoped?"
Something flickered in Lady Tremaine's eyes, as if she hadn't expected such a cheeky question from the country bumpkin her former lover had married.
"The salmon was certainly of exceptional quality everywhere. And may I tender my congratulations on your marriage? I am sure Lord Renworth is an exceedingly fortunate man to have won your hand."
"He thanks his lucky stars every day," Louisa said sweetly. She turned to him.
"My dear, best change before you catch a chill."
And then to Lady Tremaine,
"I'm sorry we didn't have advance notice of your visit, but shall we get you settled?"
Later that afternoon, another guest arrived, an expected one this time, but one as unwelcome to Felix as Lady Tremaine must be to his wife. Drummond. The man had an uncanny nose for marital discord, and rarely hesitated to take advantage of a wife's displeasure with her husband to present himself as everything the poor sod wasn't. Such tendencies had scarcely mattered to Felix when he was a bachelor, and would have scarcely mattered to him as a married man, had he and his wife remained cocooned in erotic bliss. But erotic bliss did not characterize the state of his marriage. And as Drummond monopolized Louisa after dinner, Felix felt as if he were an incarcerated convict who could only rattle the bars of his prison with impotent frustration as another man circled his wife, getting ready to exploit his absence.
"Well, tell me," said Lady Tremaine, pulling his attention back to her, "why did this girl succeed, whereas so many before her have failed?"
She had beckoned him to her earlier. They stood in a corner of the drawing-room, half separated from the rest of the crowd by a Japanese screen. He settled for a non-committal reply.
"Excellent timing."
She appeared sceptical.
"I thought you planned to marry the female equivalent of Lord Vere. Tremendous looks and very little brain."
Would that he'd adhere to that laudable plan.
"And you believed me?"
"I had no reason not to. Many men like that kind of woman."
"Obviously I decided against a dim-witted wife."
"She is rather sharp, your lady."
She leaned forward an inch.
"And how do you like married life, by the way, Felix?"
He had not thought much of Lady Tremaine's unexpected arrival. This was where she was accustomed to spending half of her August, so why should she not have availed herself of his hospitality when she found herself back in England sooner than expected? He also had not thought much of her interest in his sudden marriage. It would have come as quite a surprise to her, since the last time they spoke he'd had no idea himself that his bachelor days were coming to an end. But now he was beginning to be a little wary. There was something in the tone of her voice. Perhaps it had been there since she stepped into Huntington. But he'd been first too distracted by his wife's touch on his shirt button, and then even more distracted by the sight of her smiling at Drummond, her fan fluttering prettily.
"Married life is more or less as I'd expect it," he answered,
choosing his words carefully.
"What? No paean to marital felicity?"
"Since when do you believe in marital felicity?"
"You are right. What a vulgar concept, and quite beneath the ideal gentleman."
"I wouldn't go that far. My wife and I deal with each other very favourably, you will see. And I have every expectation we shall maintain great harmony in this house for decades to come.
Well, then, my congratulations, said Lady Tremaine.
But he was already once again distracted. In the mirror above the mantel he could see his wife, tapping on Drummond's arm with the tip of her now-closed fan, in an almost flirtatious manner. He'd thought she could not stand the man.
Thank you, my dear. Now, if you will please excuse me, I believe Drummond has something he wants to say to me.
Drummond, of course, didn't yet know that he wanted to say anything to Felix. But Felix planned to steer him into a conversation about horseflesh, and if there was anything Drummond could not resist, it was a discussion on the making of a prize-winning stallion. He set his hand for a fraction of a second on Louisa's lower back, before placing an arm around Drummond's shoulders.
I know firsthand how irresistible Lady Renworth's company is, but I do believe Mallon was hoping to arrange a match between your Gibraltar and his Lady Burke.
Oh, my! Exclaimed Drummond. Lady Burke has a fascinating bloodline, from what I've heard, a worthy match for Gibraltar.
Forgive us, Felix said to his wife, as he manoeuvred Drummond away from her. She nodded, a thin smile on her face.
Of course you are forgiven for every trespass, my lord. Always.
For days it had seemed that the house party would never end, that Louisa would always need to have her public demeanour firmly in place 16 hours a day. Then abruptly, the last full day of the party was upon them. The morning saw a vigorous tennis tournament. Louisa did not participate in the matches, but she was obliged to watch and applaud as her husband handed out one defeat after another. For several days after the handkerchief incident, it had seemed as if she were made of cold ash, incapable of even the smallest embers of lust. She had thought that it would always be so, that his contempt had permanently smothered all her yearning. Unfortunately, that had not proved the case, especially at times like this, when she must keep her eyes on him to maintain her image of the devoted bride. So much athletic grace, so much stamina, so much cleverness and strategy. The angles of his shots were a thing of beauty, not to mention from time to time sheer physical dominance, when he simply overpowered an opponent with a muscular forehand. It made her almost thankful for Mr. Drummond's presence at her side. He did not criticise Lord Renworth's technique or shot selection, but no one else escaped his criticism. And his constant fault-finding grated on her nerves, just enough for her not to be prostrate with desire for the husband who did not reciprocate it. Without that lust on his part, she was just a woman to whom he gave £5,000 a year, and who existed in the periphery of his life as a mobile ornament for the estate. After luncheon it began to rain. Many of those who had taken part in the tennis tournament were down for a nap, in order to be in top form for the bonfire party in the evening. Of those left awake, the ladies stayed in their rooms to write letters, and the gentlemen made use of the billiard room. For once, Huntington was quiet and relaxed. Louisa retreated to the window alcove in the library to spend time with a volume on the care and proper operation of telescopes. It was a wonderful book, tailored to a novice, the explanations detailed yet clear, or at least she thought so. She could be reading a housekeeping manual for all she knew. Why had he married her at all? And was that the limit of her womanly appeal, all exhausted in a single night? He made her miss the man who had boldly schemed to make her his mistress. At least that man had wanted her enough to take risks and damn the consequences, whereas this man... A thousand times she had cautioned herself against trusting him. But stupidly, she had been anxious only that she should not translate the physical pleasures he would give her into cascading verses of love, that he would distance himself from her during the honeymoon itself, the thought had never even crossed her mind. The door of the library opened. The alcove was hidden behind a bookshelf
that could slide along on concealed rails. It offered wonderful privacy, but on the other hand, the bookshelf, its back entirely panelled, made it difficult for Louisa to see who had come into the library. But the sound of the gate was nothing like her husband's. A woman, most probably. The woman made a round in the library and left after less than a minute. A light fog had descended on the lake along with the rain, obscuring the opposite bank like a gauzy curtain. But now that curtain drew apart, and Louisa found herself looking directly at the Greek folly. "A marble column pavilion stands by this lake." A quick sentence in a matter-of-fact guidebook. Yet in those days when he had tormented her with the possibility of becoming his mistress, she had concocted an entire three-act play around that setting. Act One. The girl, staring longingly at the great manor from across the lake, is ravished in the shadows of the pavilion. Act Two. The girl, staring longingly at her evilly perfect lover, is ravished all across the grounds of his extensive estate. Act Three. The girl, back home after a fortnight of ravishment, stumbling about like an empty shell of her former self, hears the doorbell ring at a most unusual hour. A two-and-a-half-act play, rather. The clear-eyed realist that she was had never been able to picture opening the door of her house to him. The real Lord Renworth would not call, write, or send presents. She would just have to wait months upon months before staring longingly at him again. Then he'd proposed, and her world had turned upside down in the most pleasurable way. And she had forgotten that around him she always needed her shield and her sword, had walked into the dragon's lair naked and unarmed, with nothing but the foolish conviction that the dragon would never incinerate a girl he liked. But looking back, ought she to have been surprised? He had deliberately made her simmer in a state of arousal at the dinner at Lady Tenwessel's house. He had clearly enjoyed informing her that her preferred suitors were both deeply flawed. Not to mention he had never experienced the slightest qualm about enticing a respectably raised virgin to sell her body. Why shouldn't such a man prove himself capricious and heartless? The door of the library opened and closed again. "There is no one here," said a woman. "I came through just a minute ago." "Lady Tremaine."
"And pray tell, why is the lack of a public so important?"
That serene voice belonged to none other than Louisa's husband. "Privacy is always nice, don't you agree?" He chuckled but gave no reply. They were coming closer. There was a rustling of fabric, the sound of a woman sitting down and adjusting her skirts. "Care for a seat, Felix?" Lady Tremaine sounded as if she were speaking directly into Louisa's ear.
"I will be able to better admire your toilette, Philippa, from my superior vantage point right here," he answered.
There was a smile in his voice, a cool smile. Lady Tremaine laughed. A sultry sound.
"Look all you want, Felix."
A long pause. Lurid images exploded in Louisa's head. Then Lady Tremaine spoke again. She did not sound as if there were a man pressed against her.
"Congratulations on your stellar results in the tennis tournament."
"Thank you."
"You were very, very vigorous." "I am a man of 28, rusticating in the country. If I didn't abound with energy, I'd need to consult my physician."
"You are also a man on your honeymoon. Shouldn't you have conserved a bit of stamina for pleasuring your wife?"
"Your concern is very kind, but I am sure I will somehow gather the wherewithal to see my wife to her satisfaction."
"Liar! Maybe you can, but are you? For every day of my stay, I have seen you from my window at 4:30 in the morning, coming back into the house."
It was hardly news to Louisa, but that Lady Tremaine should know about it. She flushed with hot shame. Lord Renworth did not address Lady Tremaine's point, but instead asked,
"What were you doing up at 4:30 in the morning?"
"Having trouble sleeping, obviously."
The sound of rustling silk again, and of someone standing up. Footsteps. Louisa imagined Lady Tremaine circling Lord Renworth like a she-wolf about to pounce.
"I have been observing your wife. I do not believe she loves you. I do not even believe she likes you."
He was silent for a long time. Louisa hoped he was at least chagrined that anyone would toss such a thing in his face. It was almost enough to make her embrace Lady Tremaine in friendship.
"My wife does not like to make her sentiments public," he said at last. "What she feels, only she and I know."
Lady Tremaine snorted at his answer.
"So I am right, then. Don't worry, I won't demand to know the why and wherefore of her sentiments, or yours. I am interested only in what you can do to help me sleep better."
Louisa found it difficult to remain quiet. She seemed to be able to take in air only in huge gulps. Even with her hands over her mouth, her trembling inhalations echoed in her hiding space.
"Since we are both awake in the middle of the night," continued Lady Tremaine, "come and make love to me instead. At least you know I like you. In fact, sometimes I adore you."
A tempting offer," he said.
"One that you'd regret declining."
"Would I?"
His words were low and soft.
"You remember what it was like."
Lady Tremaine's voice was all willful seduction.
"We were magnificent together."
"I remember."
"Midnight, then?"
"I haven't said I'd come."
"You'd be a fool not to, wouldn't you?"
And she departed on that triumphant note, walking out of the library. The closing of the door echoed in the silence. Louisa gasped when the bookshelf was pushed aside.
"I thought you might be here," her husband said coolly, as if he hadn't just failed to turn down an invitation to adultery.
And what should she say in return? "Sleep with her and I will give you a concussion with my telescope stand?" "Yes," she said, "it's a comfortable spot. Pretty view, too."
"I will leave you to your reading, then."
"Thank you," she said politely. Then she bent her face to her book, indicating that she had nothing else to say to him. A few seconds later, the bookshelf slid back into place, shutting her in. Felix remained where he was. He wanted to leave, but his feet were rooted in place, and his hands kept reaching out to push the bookshelf aside again. Madly enough, he didn't want to shove her against the wall and claim her with the force of an asteroid strike. In his mind, he sat down next to her, and together they watched the clouds depart in the wake of the rain, revealing a clear, spotless afternoon sky. He left only when he must, to supervise the preparation of the fire pit, with an emptiness in his heart that felt, unhappily, all too familiar, along with a strange anxiety. He wasn't worried about what Lady Tremaine might or might not do. He knew her very well. If she wanted him, it was only as a distraction. Something about her Scandinavian trip had upset her. His wife, on the other hand. On bonfire nights, no formal dinners were laid out. Instead, a buffet supper was served on the grand terrace, which had been lit with dozens of lanterns suspended from a pergola set up specifically for the occasion. His sense of misgiving doubled when she appeared on the terrace, clad in the same dinner gown she'd worn on their wedding night. Without looking left or right, she went directly to Drummond, who bowed and kissed her hand. They stood by the balustrade and chatted, ignoring the buffet supper altogether. As they spoke, with only the barest nod at subtlety, Drummond inched toward her. She seemed perfectly conversant with the game.
From time to time she would rest the tip of her closed fan against his chest to slow his inexorable progress, and once in a while she would slide a foot to the left to keep a respectable distance between them. Then all of a sudden, not only did she stop moving away, she leaned toward Drummond. And when he lowered his head to say something in her ear, she tilted her face and gave him a sideways smile. A smile that spoke of a Greek folly lit by torches, of slender columns that could barely conceal a grown woman, and of hot, frantic coupling in the shadows, perhaps only a few yards from those who oohed and aahed over the display of fireworks. In the wake of the smile, she whispered to Drummond and pointed to the very pavilion across the water, the one Felix could not look at without an echoing sense of loss. She left Drummond with a flirtatious caress of her fan down his arm to mix with the other guests. Felix felt as if there were a hand at his throat choking him. He had not turned down Lady Tremaine flat because he had not wanted to interrogate her on why she was propositioning him out of the blue, knowing that they were not truly alone. He found Lady Tremaine and led her down to the lawn, out of earshot of the others. Regretting it yet?
I don't know what you mean.
You do know what I mean. You were wondering whether to have a headache or pretend to be too drunk when I showed up at midnight.
She sighed. Why must you know me so well?
I assume it's not anything your Scandinavian lovers said or did. He doubted that she'd had any lovers at all. She was not the sort to sleep with a man on a short acquaintance.
She looked away. Tremaine was in Copenhagen.
Her permanently absent husband. At his sister's house?
No. I mean, I'm sure that's where he was staying, but we ran into each other quite accidentally.
She exhaled.
And he had a woman with him.
I'm sorry.
She shrugged. It's just the shock of it. I will be all right in no time.
He touched her on her arm. Come back at Christmas. I'll pack the house with handsome men and you can have your pick.
She laughed rather valiantly, a hand reaching up to adjust the scarf his valet had draped about his neck against the eventual chill of the night. That's right, instead of the ugly men you usually host. Her barely beneath the surface pain reverberated inside his own chest. He was feeling too much these days, and no longer knew how to stop. He squeezed her hand.
I will even get rid of the homelier footman just for you. They both laughed rather valiantly at that. She kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you, Felix.
And, of course, his wife would choose that moment to look his way, her gaze hardening into daggers. At 10 minutes to midnight, Felix walked into the folly. His wife was already there, her hand on a pillar, looking toward the bonfire on the opposite shore of the lake. He still couldn't quite believe it. That she had arranged a rendezvous with a man she actively disliked, just to spite him.
Beautiful, isn't it, this house?
She said, without glancing behind her. I used to study a tiny picture of it, and imagine how it would look in person, lit up like this, impossibly majestic against the night. He had come to tell her that he had already dispatched Drummond, by letting it be known that a man to whom Drummond owed a large gaming debt would be among those coming to watch the fireworks at midnight. Drummond had fled almost before Felix had stopped speaking, rather to Felix's disappointment. He would have preferred to enjoy the man's panic for a bit longer. Her head tilted up. And such stars! Have I ever told you of my interest in astronomy? I have always been intrigued by the night sky ever since I was a child. To think that there is a vast universe out there, full of deep, marvellous unknowns. She had never told him directly of her fascination with the stars, never allowed him to share her sense of wonder.
But you didn't come to hear me prattle on. Please proceed with what we've agreed upon.
He felt a burning in his throat.
What we've agreed upon?
What had they agreed upon? He meant to speak, to let her know that Drummond had vacated the premises. Instead, he found himself standing directly behind her, his hands on her cool, bare arms. She trembled. With disgust or desire? How could she feel anything for that dunce, whom Felix tolerated only because he was nephew to Felix's former guardian? He kissed her hair, the lobe of her ear, the side of her neck, his finger spreading over her collarbone.
Such a workmanlike approach, sir. No praise for my slender throat or my velvety skin?
He bit her shoulder in response, not hard, just enough for her to emit a sob of arousal.
"Did you bring the blindfold?"
she asked, her voice unsteady. His hand tightened. That, too, was a fantasy that belonged to them. She couldn't have displayed a little originality and found something different for Drummond to do. He took off his scarf and used it to blindfold her. She turned around. A little hesitantly, her hand lifted and felt its way to his jaw. Could she not tell that it was him?
I used to dream of riding in a glass carriage, naked and blindfolded. There was a man in the carriage with me. It doesn't matter who the man was. All that matters is that...
He silenced her with a hard kiss. He could take no more of her cruel words, nor could he care any more that he was giving in to his obsession. She kissed him back, almost as bruisingly, her hands gripping his hair. He pushed her against the pillar as she dragged his shirt up, her hands hungry for his skin. He had no recollection of either shoving aside her skirts or freeing himself from the encumbrance of his trousers. The next thing he knew was a desperate upward plunge as he entered her and the gasps that echoed between them. The ferocity of her lips, the avarice of her hands, the sheer agonizing scorch of her person. He didn't know how he remembered to clamp a palm over her mouth, perhaps only when he heard someone calling from no more than 15 feet away. "Quick, the fireworks are about to start!"
Their own fireworks ignited first.
He barely protested before surrendering to the demonic pleasures of her body, clenching and shuddering about his.
She was heavenly. Her hair smelled of chamomile, her skin was paradise, her hips beneath his hands sweetly pliant.
But reality seeped back, winding a cord of dismay around his heart softly, nearly imperceptibly. Then there came a sharp, cruel yank.